we said, okay, actually we need to start measuring food waste first of all in order to understand where it's coming from, how much is wasted, and then we can start optimizing it and reducing it.
So welcome to Brave Bold Brilliant podcast. I'm here today with Anna Hoffman. Now, Anna is the co-founder of a really interesting business called Kytro that is actually solving the problem of food wastage. So welcome, Anna. Nice to see you.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Now, I first came across your really fascinating business via one of your colleagues, Simon, when I was at the TUI Blue conference in Cape Verde a couple of months ago. I was delivering the keynote speech and actually had the chance to sit in on one of the workshops. And in that workshop, my mind was blown by the fact that 30% of all food produced in the world is wasted today. And that just seems like a crime when we know that there are millions of people starving in certain parts of the world. So Anna, clearly a massive big problem globally, and Kytro is helping solve that problem. But do you want to just talk about how you got into this as such an important topic for you personally, and then what led you to start the business?
Yes, sure. So as you mentioned, you met my co-worker and colleague Simon at a hotel conference or event, basically. So we are really focused on the hospitality food service industry with our company. How we got into it, it was really Naomi, my co-founder, and I, we met at university. We studied international hospitality management. And so we both worked a lot in the industry throughout our studies, as extras next to our studies, the different internships. And that's really where we noticed this massive issue firsthand, because Naomi was focused more on back of house kitchen, I was more in front of house, but we both were just kind of like shocked by the amount of food we just wasted on a daily basis in the establishment where we worked in. And witnessing this firsthand really gave us the motivation to look a bit further into the topic. At the time, we were both working in Miami Beach. And so the States is, of course, also known for the big portions, very generous portions, especially if you compare it with Switzerland, where I'm based. And so there, we were also shocked at these events that we would host, that so much was wasted. And then we would go home on our way along Miami Beach and saw all these homeless people and I thought, okay, this is kind of a very strange distribution and how much waste is there anyway? And we started really questioning this. And so once this spark was kind of there, we looked into finding data on food waste and realized there's really not a lot of data on food waste. And that's when we said, okay, actually we need to start measuring food waste first of all, in order to understand where it's coming from, how much is wasted, and then we can start optimizing it and reducing it.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, and like you say, it's a massive number. I mean, 30%, you know, this isn't just, the odd half plate full of food being thrown away. I mean, that's a huge amount. It has massive implications for, the global economy, for, climate change. Everything is kind of, deeply impacted by this. So when you were sort of seeing that this problem existed and you were thinking about how do you solve it, was that when you actually came up with the idea for Kytro, or did you have a couple of other sort of reiterations before you actually started the business, Anna?
No, it was pretty straightforward actually for us. So often you hear startups pivoting a few times, which is, it's important to stay open and then pivot if you have to. But for us, it was because we worked in the industry, really understood the processes within a kitchen and kind of already had this good understanding of what the device kind of needs to be able to do, and also the requirements in general in terms of effort for our customers. And so with that in mind, we could really get started and have support from some students actually at the time from ETH, which is a tech school, a tech university in Zurich, to build the first prototype.
Right, fantastic. So for anyone listening, do you want to just explain what Kytro does? I have seen it firsthand, and it's really clever what the proposition is and how you help in particular in the hospitality trade. So do you want to explain what Kytro does?
Sure. Yeah. So what we do, we provide the hospitality businesses. So these are big hotel chains, restaurant groups, and also canteens, cafeterias, and universities, medical centers. So these are our customers. And we provide them with a hardware device. So it's a scale. Imagine just a scale. They put their green bin on top of the scale. So it's just organic bin, basically. And on top, there is a little camera with lights. And every time something is thrown out, we take an image and we take the weight. And the timestamp, basically. This data is then sent to our software where we're using image processing and machine learning algorithms. So AI, the buzzword of since a few years, but we're using AI to identify exactly what has been wasted at that property. And at the end of the day, what is actually the biggest part of our product is not the hardware itself or the algorithms, it's really the data, the analysis that we then give to our customers via an online dashboard so they can log in, they see exactly how much was wasted, where did the waste come from, like the sources and so on, and of course also the cost and the impact related to that. And based on that, we give them also support. So having data is of course the first step, but then what do you actually do? How do you actionize on this data? And that's also where we guide our customers through the customer journey and effectively give them consulting.
Yeah, so for example, imagine you're on a holiday. I'm just sort of trying to paint the pictures to how I saw it. You're in the hotel buffet restaurant, and of course you're helping yourself to all of this delicious food in front of you with lots of different, dishes available, all inclusive, let's just say. And people tend to have more on their plate than they're going to eat, shall we say? And this device that you have, it allows the hotelier to see, well, actually, are we wasting a lot of pasta, for example, or bread, or is it on the breakfast that the bacon is not being actually eaten and is being thrown away? So it allows that real detail so that then the hotel and the F&B team are able to adjust how much they produce in the first place to reduce the waste, right? So it's really clever. I mean, I saw it firsthand and I was just like, wow, how cool is this? It's really, really must be hugely beneficial for the clients. And what sort of results are you seeing, Anna, with the clients that you work with? How is having that data and knowledge and insight and your consultancy, how is that helping them reduce their amount of waste? What's a typical reduction based on kind of working with Kitro?
Yeah. So on average, our customers, once they've measured with us for a minimum of 4 months, they can see savings up to, so on average, more than 30% of their food, avoidable food waste, can be saved. And 30% in our opinion is already a really, really good start. And I say avoidable food waste or edible food waste because we make this distinction and really look at what was effectively edible versus not edible, because the unedible part or inedible part is, yeah, eggshells, bones, and so on. And that is not, that's part of cooking, right? So we really look at, okay, first, as a first instance, what was edible, and of this edible portion, how much did you reduce? And that's 30% on average, but the good performers, they've reduced way, way more. So there's really, it depends really also on the team on site. How open they are to implement actions, how motivated they are, but there's big, big savings you can do.
Yeah, fantastic. So let's talk about AI for a little bit. As you said, it's like the buzzword of the sort of the last probably two years, I would say. And it's been used in so many clever ways. How is that changing, Anna? Obviously you've got really cutting edge technology with what you do, but is that evolving over time? Are you finding that the data is becoming more rich? What's happening in the world of AI for you?
Yes, of course. So when we started, so we were really using image processing. And so for those that maybe have not been exposed to that before, a quick explanation of how our technology works. In simple terms, it's like teaching a kid what the different food items are. So you would tell a toddler, maybe these are fries. And then the kid, next time it maybe forgets it. But then after 3 times telling him or her, the kid would know, right? Even if the fries are not exactly the same way on the plates than they were before. And the same is with our AI. We call him Sherlock. And so Sherlock, first we had to teach him, give him a lot of kind of labeled images, these are fries, and then now he recognizes fries without any problems. And so since day one, for our customers, it was always fully automated, but in the back end, we've trained our algorithms first manually by annotating these images, and then and now he can take over more and more of these food items. And so this is actually really a process that has been going on since we started. It's still, we're still improving Sherlock month on month. So he's really getting better and better. Also, as we expand, we go maybe into new cuisine types. And so then maybe he hasn't seen pak choi so often. So then it goes back to someone that kind of confirms if he's unsure this is pak choi indeed. And so then he learns it again by himself.
Wow, yeah, it's super clever, isn't it? It's a bit mind-boggling. You know, if you were talking about this 5 years ago, someone would have thought it was a scientific sci-fi movie or something, but it's very much reality. And how has the business grown, Anna? So you started in 2017 with your co-founder, Naomi. And how was the business back then when you first started? What was the early days like? And then where are you now in your entrepreneurial journey in terms of the size and scale of the business?
Yeah, naturally, when we started, it was all quite, it felt like a project I did with my best friend. So it was very fun. We came out of university and had this vision and decided to just continue working on it and see where it goes. So there was not a lot of expectation tied to it either from our end. I think it was just, we enjoyed working together and we enjoyed working on this project. And so the early days were really focused on just building this first MVP, getting a first customer, hiring a first employee. So there was just lots of these firsts, which are extremely exciting. And so you really also learn a lot, of course. There are also firsts that, like firing the first person or having to let go someone, that's also a first. So definitely the early days were lots of learning. So the strong focus on building up our prototype, always taking into consideration our customers' feedback. So we've built up this whole product basically in a constant iteration, always checking in with our customers where we can go next and what they need and how we can improve it. And compared to now we're a team of 20 people, mostly based in Switzerland still, but we also have some people that work remotely, which is quite cool, a hybrid work style. And of course, the dynamics have changed a bit. It has become more serious for sure, but it's still, you still feel this, like, I think fun is kind of, or enjoying the ride is one of our values, and you can still feel that because it is quite a nice work environment still in that sense.
Yeah, fantastic. I mean, you know, you've got 20 people in the business, so it's still pretty lean operation, and yet you are working with some really big global brands, which, you know, I guess shows the power of technology, but also the fact that you solve a significant problem for your clients, right? So, I mean, TUI is one of your clients, and TUI, well, my previous employer as well, way back, you know, so that's a great brand to have. Where do you see the business moving from in terms of the next stage of the type of clients that you're going to have? Is it more on the hotel side? Is it more on, as you said, you know you're in hospitals or schools, etc.? I guess there's a whole different direction you could go in, but where do you think you'll go with the client side of things?
I think we will continue to have both segments, canteens, cafeterias, but also hotel clients. We see, however, that from the hotel client side or hotels in general, there's a big push towards sustainable actions. And you see this really in the global brands. They all have now, or they've had already for multiple years, but the sustainability targets they've set themselves, they're becoming more and more concrete, which is also quite in line with the current trend when you're looking at regulations that are coming in on the EU level, for example, different country-based regulations when it comes to ESG topics or sustainability in general. And so that is definitely a big push factor for the hotel groups, because they also see that on an individual level, so their guests, they're also requiring or requesting more sustainable actions or visibility, transparency, and so on. And so food waste reduction or measurement already, just measuring your food waste gives you a number that you can have to also monitor and add to your impact report if you want, or see what changed, right? So that this number is quite valuable for them.
Yeah.
And we see that more and more, that also big brands, they just make it also mandatory for all their hotel brands or hotels in a certain region to measure food waste. And that's, of course, a very important, I think, movement towards more sustainable actions.
Yeah, I mean, I do a lot of advisory work for Accor Hotels, which I'm sure you'll know Accor. They've got multiple brands, and Brune Poyson is their chief sustainability officer, and they're doing a lot of good things. I mean, obviously, a big focus around plastics and stuff like that. You know, carbon, you know, which is high on the list for everyone. But food waste, I think, is yeah, is something that people are becoming more and more aware of. And, you know, Anna, what are the things that actually the customer needs to do? You know, so I think very often people are unaware of how they're contributing to the problem. You know, so as I say, if you're a customer staying in a hotel and you're loading up your plate full of food because you think, oh, I'm all inclusive, it's free, and this mindset of let me just get the most I can, you know, but actually there's one side working with the hotelier and the F&B team, but the other side is actually educating the customer, that the customer who's the guest. Is there anything that you do in that space at the moment? And also, what do you think needs to happen to make a change in those initial decisions that people are making when they are choosing food?
Yeah, no, this is a really important point. I think we work directly with B2B, so with the businesses, but of course, every individual actually has a big, big influence. And I think that is often forgotten, that by the choices you make three times a day when you eat something, you actually make a choice every time that has an influence on the environment, because the demand drives the supply. And that's the same for hotels, right? Like, they offer these buffets because they think customers demand them. And we hear this quite often. So I think this is important for everyone to know, that, like, be aware of your consumption and the choices you make, but also by asking, for example, hotels, then, okay, where is this from? Or what do you do in terms of sustainable actions? That in turn shows them that their guests are interested and drives them to make more changes, or make changes in general. And also maybe gives them this opportunity, or takes away the fear of the guest in a way, and disappointing a guest. I think that is something we are confronted with quite a bit, but we have now had a few customers already. They stopped completely offering buffets because they said, you know what, it is something that people are used to and maybe expect, but we will communicate to them. And that's also where we support our customers. So we not only support them in internally communicating the project around food waste, but also give them materials that they can externally communicate to their customers as well, what they're doing. And that's quite important. And this is in general also why we work a lot with universities, hospitality management schools, where we participate in some electives or give keynote speeches there around the topic of food waste, because it is important to just also raise awareness.
Yeah, definitely. And like you say, you know, sometimes it's not an all or nothing solution, you know. So if you talk about the buffets, I mean, I spent most of my career in the travel industry, you know, and a lot of that in terms of package holidays and the expectations, etc. But, you know, sometimes it's like, well, don't have the buffet option at lunchtime, because at lunchtime people probably want a lighter meal, maybe they're by the pool, you know, so maybe have the buffet when there's a volume that demands it. So I think it's just that education. One of the interesting things that actually Accor are doing as well in the Middle East is they are putting on all of their menus the carbon impact of the menu choice. And that's not common across a lot of places yet, but I think that will be something that comes along. Even like, you know, if you think about menus where now very often it'll show the calories and the fat kind of, you know, so there's information. It's not forcing the customer to choose one or another, but it's giving them the information, the data, as you say, to make an informed choice that maybe they wouldn't do if that wasn't there, because they just don't know. We only know what we know. What are your thoughts on that carbon kind of menus, I suppose?
Yeah, I think it helps people definitely to kind of see, oh, this is the difference if I take the meal with beef and versus the vegetarian meal. The number is massive. I've seen it also with like more of a kind of traffic light system. Because what I notice as well is this CO2 number it's very intangible for many people. They don't fully understand maybe yet what it entails. Is that a lot? Is it not a lot? I had the same issue when I started, and it is a number that you need to get used to and put in kind of like a context with something to fully understand the impact. But I think it's a great movement, and we see it more and more as well with the CO2 like labels that are out there, or even, yeah, as you say, on menus.
Yeah. So Anna, let's talk a little bit around your entrepreneurial journey, because I think it's fantastic what you're doing on the sustainability side and how you're solving a genuine problem, not only for the clients that you work with, but also for, you know, the harmony of our planet and looking after this this planet that we have. But on the entrepreneurial side, you know, when you started out, you don't necessarily know how to be a good businesswoman, right? Or a good business person.
No.
You
they
start,
don't teach you that.
No, exactly. Unless you went to, you know, to kind of management school or whatever. But and even then, it's quite theoretical, right? So you started, like you said, you know, with Naomi, because it was almost like a project, something you were both passionate about, doing a project with your best friend. And that DNA, that purpose-led approach, I think is still very, you know, what drives the business today. So you don't want to lose any of that, obviously. But what have you had to kind of adapt to in terms of being a business owner that maybe you found a little bit more difficult? What were the things that were harder for you? What were the things that came more easily for you?
Yes, definitely. I think you don't graduate and know how to run a business. That's something you hopefully grow into over the years. I think, especially with leadership, I think it's really something you learn the more mistakes you do or things that work well, right? And even from other people that we've hired later in the stage that were more experienced, we learned quite a big deal from them as well, how they do their leadership. But I think at the end of the day, you need to find your own style, how it works for you. For us, it changed because at the beginning, as I said, we were really a short team, the two of us. And so it was all, even the first few years when we were like five people, six people, it's still quite light, right? You don't have a lot of processes, you move fast, it's your friends with everyone, you hang out after work all the time. And at some point there was really this kind of moment where it switched, where we stopped hanging out with everyone all the time, and where we actually we still of course do that, but we also realized, okay, you cannot really be friends with everyone because it's growing too much. But also we kept it in the business, as it's still this really nice atmosphere, but also there is more processes, there is a hierarchy, and that is maybe something that we initially struggled maybe a bit, because we always wanted this really flat hierarchy and not have an organizational charge and not be like the bosses that make all the decisions. And then at some point we realized that people actually even wanted that, because, and it was needed. We started to see why big organizations have that, because you need to have a supervisor and be able to know who to go to if you have a question or a problem. And so we started to really, build a bit more structures up in our organization and moving forward. And it's working really well. So it's also a learning for us. In terms of also what you communicate to the team, when you communicate it. So these are definitely things that changed quite a bit, but it's still keeping this early spirit, of course.
Yeah, no, and it is. It's a challenge, because what you need when you start a business is not what you need when you're scaling a business. It's not what you're needing when you're maybe exiting a business,
exactly.
You know. So all these different kind of, you know, it's almost like having a, you know, a baby, then a toddler, then a teenager, you know, and you're going through the different phases. So you're growing as well as an individual through this process, you know, which is great to hear. And, you know, before we press record, we were talking a little bit about your finance. And, you know, starting the business, you probably bootstrapped it, you know, at the beginning, you're putting a bit of your own money in and kind of funding it that way. Whereas as you scale, there comes a point for any business owner, and maybe someone listening now might be at this stage themselves, where they need capital in order to scale up, to grow, to invest in technology, whatever it may be, marketing, branding, etc. So you have been in that world, haven't you, of raising finance?
Yeah. Exactly.
And it can be quite painful. It can be stressful. It can be, you know, the highs, the lows. And again, you're appealing to a different audience, aren't you? You've got to speak to someone with an investment mindset rather than an end client that's thinking about the operational benefit. So how have you found that process? What are some of the lessons and some of the things that you've kind of has gone well, and some of the things that maybe you do differently next time?
Yeah, so we did two funding rounds, equity funding rounds with external investors, business angels. Obviously, if you're starting out, usually the first investors are business angels or even friends, family. We didn't really want to involve our family too much. So we had business angels joining, family offices. And that the first round back in 2018, actually, it was compared to what came after, and we didn't know at the time, was actually quite smooth. So that one was good. We found a great mentor who also invests, and he was our mentor first, and then once we started raising our round, he really supported us. Also, he brought in his friends and invested, and he's been on our board since then. And I think in general, we've been really lucky with our investors and who's kind of been attracted to Kytro and who's on our cap table, because they are all sharing the values. And yeah, we hear sometimes horror stories of startups that are really struggling with their investors. And we've been super lucky that we were able to attract people and have people support us that are really aligned with our values and trust us also how we run the business and where we want to go. The second round was a bit harder, but if you fast forward, we closed it last year, and in between we've done some convertible note rounds, and those are of course an interesting vehicle to raise funds. Quite easy, I would say, if you need fast money as a company, and defer kind of the pricing discussion to later. And then but in terms of the whole environment and how it changed globally, so just really the economical environment and the whole situation with COVID, and then people were, the war started in the Ukraine, and all these factors really led to a different fundraising environment. And we heard it in the news, the tech giants laying off hundreds of thousands of people, and all the valuations cut in half or even more. So this definitely affected us as well, in the sense that then the next fundraising round was took more effort. It was definitely a longer process than to close that round.
And did the type of investor change as well? You said, you know, you very much started with that group of angels that were quite well known to you personally through the mentoring and then those individual relationships. But have you gone more down the line of venture capitalists, kind of more the institutional type, well, maybe smaller institutionals, but institutional money as opposed to kind of angels now?
Yeah, smaller institutions, still angels and like just really business angels that believe in the business. So we're still the majority on our cap table, but we have some early stage VCs now as well.
Yeah, so you've got to mix them, and they will require different kinds of communication, different sure. level of governance. You know, my God, governance, let's talk about that. but no, that's great. I mean, you know, congratulations on kind of, you know, getting the capital into the business so that you can grow, because that in itself is not easy. But I think you made a really valid point before around, think about, and this is advice to people that are maybe at the stage that you were at a few years ago of needing to get capital into the business, but be really, I always say, be really clear on what you're looking for from an investor, especially if you're giving away equity. If you're talking about, you know, straightforward loans, then that's easy. You know, that's straightforward. But if you're giving away equity, you've got to be careful who you're getting in bed with. And is it,
exactly.
You know, it's almost like a marriage, right? You've got to kind of, but you've got to plan for the potential divorce at the end and be really clear on kind of who you're taking on board. And it's not always about the money. Sometimes it might be around a particular skill set, experience. Maybe they bring their network and, you know, black book of contacts. You know, what is it that you're looking for over and above just the money? And did you find that played a part for you, Anna, in choosing the investors? Or was it more around just the capital that you needed?
I mean, if you're in the position to choose your investors, that's a super nice position to be in, right? So, but usually if you are, at least in our experience, we're a really impact-driven startup. And so we naturally kind of attracted impact-driven investors, which was quite nice. Of course, there as well, we've had cases where we didn't align on let's say, future growth targets? Or, and I think that is, in terms of advice to people that are fundraising or looking to raise, the question you definitely need to answer yourself first is, am I going for, like, what is my goal in the next 5 years? Am I really going to push, get lots of money in, grow this business and exit it in 5 to 7 years? Because that's usually the time horizon that a VC would expect you to then sell your business, right? Mm. And so is that the plan for my business? Or is it a different plan, a different target? Do we want to grow slower maybe and focus on profitability first? Or do we want to find a good balance between the two, right? So, but that is something you need to really think about first, because even impact-driven investors, some are quite focused on, because they have LPs and they need to have a return at their business too, right? So don't forget that. So they are focused maybe on this fast growth versus not so much. And I think that is important for yourself to answer, that you also get not only the people that are interested in a similar, have the similar value, but also that they have similar expectations around growth and where you'll be in 5 years from now.
Yeah, that's really good advice. And I think you're right, actually, to spend some time thinking about that upfront will save you a lot of heartache later. You know, and very important. I always say with the businesses that I advise, start with the end in mind and work backwards, you know, so because you're right. If you're building a business to hold on to and to pass on to the next generation, that is very, very different than if you're looking to exit and have a full exit in 5, 10 years. You know, you will make different choices depending on what that end thing is. And for you, Anna, obviously you're growing the business. You and Naomi are doing really well along with the rest of the team. Do you foresee some kind of exit in the future, or are you open-minded to kind of that next, you know, that journey forward? What are your thoughts? And you might not be able to say, so please don't feel you have to answer the question. If it's a little bit, we're not sure, we're working it through, then that's also kind of fine, you know?
Yeah, no, I think so. We don't have a fixed plan, say, to exit in 3 years to this partner, right? Like, that is not yet set in stone. We are quite flexible. We see the market, the food waste market is quite dynamic right now. There is lots going on. And so we're quite open-minded around that topic and see if there is a partner we see that could make sense, and we see that they have similar values and they would have a great plan with Kaito that is aligned with also what we would see, then, you know, definitely open. But there's not a fixed exit plan right now.
Yeah,
but some ideas for sure.
Yeah, and that's great. You know, like you say, scope out your different options, and you know, you can kind of evaluate those. And mergers can be great as well, right? As long as you've got the right, you know, the right combination, that can also be a good solution in terms of scaling up as well. But again, choose your partner well. I think is always the message. And Anna, between yourself and Naomi, obviously you started the business together. How do you I assume you've got some common skills, but you've probably got also quite specific areas of expertise. How have you sort of defined your roles as co-founders going forward? Because again, I think that's probably something that maybe people struggle with at first. You know, everyone's doing a little bit of everything at the beginning, and as you grow, you kind of need to have a bit more focus on where you're best placed to add value to the business. So how do you and Naomi split your kind of time and focus?
Yeah, it has changed actually quite a bit. Initially, we, as you said, we started out, everyone just kind of did whatever they could, and then we became a bit more focused. So I focused more on finance, investor relations, and at that time still HR and kind of, yeah, this internal admin, I would say. It happened quite naturally. And then Naomi was more like sales, partnerships and marketing, and also some product development. And as we grew, we kind of, yeah, got deeper in certain roles. But then last year, we decided to switch to departments. So we switched HR and marketing. And I took over marketing, and Naomi took over HR, which was a great idea, because I think it's actually a luxury. It's like you get a bit of a new job in your own company, and you learn a lot again, and you bring in new ideas. And for her as well, the taking over HR was something that she really was excited about, because it's a department she hasn't actively like led. And so this was quite a cool cool way to just also expand your personal growth and learn more.
Yeah, fantastic. And like you say, when you're the boss, you can decide how you want to split things up, can't you? So that's quite nice. So one of the advantages of being your own boss and owning the company. And when it comes to sort of, I suppose, the next phase of development for the business, do you see yourself going more further afield in terms of international growth? Do you see it's more around the markets that you're currently in and maybe expanding the offering? Which direction do you think you might go in?
Yeah, I think a bit of both, but first and foremost, the expansion right now is quite a big focus for us. We are now in over 20 countries, which is quite exciting. Also by being preferred partners, for example, of Hyatt EMEA or even one of the preferred partners of Four Seasons Hotels. So that allowed us to expand quite quickly in the Middle East and also in having first properties now over, I think over 10 properties already in the United States. And so that's definitely the focus, to just continue growing with international, like growing with international groups, while also focusing still on the DACH region, which is where, kind of our home turf, as we started out in Switzerland. And then in terms of expansion of product, there's always lots of ideas. So unfortunately can't do it all, but definitely still the current product we have, improving it, launching new versions, new features, and so on. So that's also still
Fantastic. Yeah, that's great. And Anna, what obviously you'll have had lots of, highs and lows through your journey so far. You're still very young, which is great. Lots of energy, and passion for what you're doing, which is wonderful. Can you think of a particular highlight or something that you're really proud of, or a moment where you felt, oh my God, yeah, this is amazing? Any kind of standout moments?
Oh, we had so many standout moments, I think, and that's also what makes this really rewarding. And it kind of like makes it worth, because you also have a lot of low moments, right? Really high highs and really low lows. So it's important to also focus on the highlights. Yeah, to pick one, it's very hard. I think becoming definitely like certain milestones we hit, like the first time you have more than 100 devices active or more than 200, like these records that you keep breaking, that is very motivating also for the team. We have these milestone meetings every month, and every month it's a highlight because there's new records that were broken and new achievements. And so couldn't pinpoint one. I think one moment that I personally think is also really, really rewarding is in these milestone meetings, when you sit there and then you have the whole team there and everyone's so excited about food waste management and shares their achievements of the month, and it's just such a nice environment. And that's usually like a moment that I really appreciate in the company, because you're just there and think, oh, this is so cool that Kiker is giving also all these people kind of not a purpose. I wouldn't want to be so arrogant to say it gives them the purpose, but it gives them an environment where they can work and be passionate about it, and that's super nice.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you say, it's a bit like when you drop a pebble in a pebble in a pond, that ripple. If you think about now, you're a team of 20, that's impacting the lives of them, and everyone who works in the organization, their families. You're making that impact globally with the hotels that you work with. So it's a really amazing business that you've got, and I think there's still a huge amount of growth still to come for you, which is exciting. And can you think of you said there were lots of low points, and I'm sure there's been times when you've been, oh my gosh, what are we doing? Like all business owners have. But any particularly really challenging times? I mean, obviously we've had COVID, and the hospitality industry was significantly affected. So that may have been a moment for you. But any particular low points that you had to really dig deep to, come through the other side?
Yeah, it was definitely, I think it was the consequences of COVID, not COVID itself, because during that time you got still some support from the government, right? So like you kind of made it through the COVID time, but the time after, when you did, so as a business, we had to raise more funds to keep going, but we didn't achieve the milestones we set out to achieve with the funds we had raised before because of COVID just shutting down our industry, all our customers. And also the effect on them was really like there for a lot longer than we anticipated, right? Like I remember in Q2 2022, actually, that was the moment where we felt, oh, okay, we can sell again, like customers are coming back and we can actually have these sales conversations again. But that was, nearly more than 2 years that we felt the effects of COVID. And then raising funds without having the traction you should have, that was very, very hard.
Yeah, absolutely. Because if you think about it, you started in 2017, COVID happened 2020. So you kind of 3 years as a, still a relatively young business at that stage, then 2 years of COVID and the challenges and then coming out the other side. So yeah, I can imagine you've had some really difficult times, but thankfully you're in a good place now, which is great. So yeah, congratulations. And Anna, when you look back through your kind of, your business life so far, and I know you've still got a long road ahead of you, but what can you think of any amazing advice that you've received that has been really helpful for you?
We've been lucky to have had extremely valuable coaches and mentors along the way. Otherwise, we would not be here where we are. If I had to pick one advice, it's probably one of the first one we ever gotten when we just had the idea on a paper. And that was by the head of innovation at the time of our hospitality management school, so EHL in Lausanne. And he said, back then the idea for Kaitra was a bit all over the place still. And he was just like, hey, why are you reinventing a wheel? Why are you trying to do a point of sale system and a recipe management system plus a waste management? Like, these systems exist. Try to focus on something that you add to, like something new that you add, basically. And so focus is definitely one of the best advice we've gotten, because that showed us to say, okay, actually, yeah, why are we building all of this? It exists already. Let's really try to pin it down to just what could we develop that doesn't exist yet.
Yeah, brilliant advice. And actually that then becomes, what you're famous for, doesn't it? It becomes the one, and it's super simple, really super simple, but so compelling. So yeah, great advice there. And if you were to describe this year in one word, Anna, what would it be and why?
I would pick the word growth, actually. It's not super creative, but it's really this first quarter of 2024 was really, we were expanding, we've been growing so much. It's been a really, really cool time so far for the year, for the team as well. And so I think I would pick growth.
Excellent. And more growth to come. I can see exponential growth potentially by the sounds of it. So that's fantastic. And Anna, brave, bold, brilliant. What does that mean to you?
Brave, bold, and brilliant. I think it goes maybe a bit in like this questioning of the status quo, I would say. So I guess that's bold and brave and also maybe brilliant, we hope so, but that would be the notion, I think. So questioning what exists and not just kind of like going with the flow and accepting everything how it's been created many, many years ago, but really seeing something and noticing and also realizing that you have the ability to drive change as an individual, and you have, that you can do this as well.
Fantastic. I love that. Yes, disrupting the status quo and really pushing out of our comfort zone, which you are definitely doing, you and Naomi, with Kaitra. So huge congratulations for everything you're achieving, Anna, and thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
I really hope you've enjoyed Brave, Bold, Brilliant. Don't forget to subscribe and share with all your friends. And if you've enjoyed listening, I'd love it if you'd leave me a 5-star review.